Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week and next, why a U.S. war against ISIS can only make the situation worse, just like every other U.S. war in the Mideast has done. Phyllis Bennis explains why. I hope you'll stay tuned. Phyllis Bennis gave a fine talk in Seattle this past February 2016, and we shall hear it, if the gods permit, this week and next. Bennis is a highly regarded writer and progressive activist. In recent years, she has focused a good deal on issues of Palestinian rights and the Israeli occupation, and more generally, on U.S. Middle East policy. And more generally still, on the bedrock U.S. foreign policy of war, war, and more war, anywhere and everywhere. Today, she will be focusing not on Palestine, but on those other flashpoints in the region, Syria, ISIS, and ISIS's home, Iraq. Bennis's credentials are pretty impressive. She's co-chair of the United Nations International Coordination Network for Palestine. She is a fellow of the Institute for Policy Studies. And she is a leader of United for Peace and Justice. She's also the author of 9 books on U.S. foreign policy and or the Middle East. On February 2nd, she spoke on the topic of her most recent book. That book is titled Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terror, a primer, that was published in 2015. This is the first I had heard her speak. I was really struck by the clarity and incisiveness and force of her words. Plus, she's an excellent speaker. Her political views are left progressive. These days, when every single one of the presidential candidates is screaming for more war in the Middle East and bigger Pentagon budgets, these days, Bennis's voice sounds like the intelligent and sane and humane one. So, don't expect to hear her on Meet the Press anytime soon. But you can hear her now, speaking on the folly of thinking we can bomb our way to peace in the Middle East. Here is Phyllis Bennis.
Thank you all for coming tonight. You know, 2 weeks ago was the 25th anniversary of the first U.S. war against Iraq in 1991. It's hard to imagine that it was that far away. It's 25 years. But if we look back at that, we can really see there the origins of the set of policy catastrophes of our country that led directly to the creation of ISIS in 2004. There's a direct line. I want to ask a question, but I can't see a thing with these lines. How many of you have heard, I'm not asking if you believe it, but how many of you have heard that ISIS was created when President Obama pulled the troops out of Iraq? Heard it, not believed it. Come on, admit it. All right, most of you, you know you've all heard it anyway. You're just not willing to admit it. Okay, we don't have to go there. But the point is, we know exactly when and how ISIS was created. We know its origins. That part, unlike some others, is not a mystery. And it was not in 2011 when President Obama pulled out the troops for a brief time. It was in 2004 when President Bush was supervising 150,000 U.S. and NATO troops that were occupying Iraq. That's what gave rise to ISIS. Not the withdrawal of troops, the presence of troops. And if we look back 25 years, we can also see a trajectory that has led to what we're now seeing, the crisis in Syria, the 8 or 9 separate wars all being fought to the last Syrian, the disaster of Libya as a result of U.S. NATO regime change, these crises across the Middle East that has led to a new global war on terror. This is, today's an anniversary as well. You all know this. This is Groundhog Day. So what's the deal with Groundhog Day? It's not the little thing they pull out of his, you know. I mean, these guys are nocturnal. They don't want to come out in the middle of the day anyway. It's like, where's PETA saying this is animal abuse? But it's not really about that. It's about this notion of repeating things. You know, it was Einstein who had this great line about the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. That hasn't changed. The U.S. is repeating its policy over and over again and thinking that because it's a different president doing the same thing with a slightly different tactic, that somehow it's going to work better. When we found out, we have a new report saying that conditions in Afghanistan are worse than ever, and the Taliban now has control of more territory than at any moment since it was overthrown in 2001. And the answer is, well, let's send more troops. Yeah, because we did so well the first time around. You know, it's this notion of Einstein was wrong. We can do the same thing over and over again, and we will get a different result. Oh, really? How's that working for you so far? You know, this is a serious problem that we're facing here. In Groundhog Day, this notion of repetitive action is very much at the root of what we have to challenge today. You know, one of the things that happened when President Obama took office, on the second day in the White House, he sent a memo. They're very big on memos in the White House. The memo went to the State Department, to the Pentagon, to the White House staff, to everybody, saying, we don't want to use the term global war on terror. That was Bush's war. We're not doing that. We want to call it something different. We're going to call it overseas contingency operations. How Orwellian is that? This notion that you can call it with such a benign name, overseas contingencies. It's like there was a flood and we're sending some operators to help rescue people. No, this is a war. Call it what it is. I always like the term global war on terror, partly because the initials, the acronym GWAT, always had that evil sound, right? This isn't exactly the same, certainly. It's not relying on hundreds of thousands of troops. From the vantage point of U.S. troops, that's a good thing. From the vantage point of how many Iraqis and Syrians and Afghans are dying, not so great. Yesterday's New York Times had a fascinating op-ed by a former Army captain, and the little jump quote in the middle of it, it's an article about special forces and how critical they have become, how central they have become to U.S. strategy in the region. And it describes top secret missions, mythical warriors, and a state of perpetual warfare. That's what U.S. policy looks like today. We hear from President Obama a very important point, which is absolutely true and crucially important. And I so wish he would make it good. He says over and over again, there is no military solution. And you want to shake him and say, well, then why is it that every action we see is a military action? Because then he adds something that isn't true. He says, you know, the military action isn't enough. We also are going to need some diplomacy and negotiations and economic things and some other things. That's wrong. The problem isn't that the military isn't enough. The problem is that the military actions make all those other crucial actions impossible. Because if you're an ordinary Sunni Iraqi, say, and you see the U.S. coming and bombing, maybe it's an ISIS camp not far from your village, and maybe they get some ISIS people, but in the meantime, they've also bombed a few others. And the response in Washington is, yay, we got the bad guys. And the response in Iraq is, yeah, there's the Americans again, bombing the Sunnis in the interests of the Shia and the Kurds. So we're exacerbating the sectarianism, we're furthering the divide among the Iraqi people that we helped put in place when we overthrew a regime, a repressive regime, no doubt, but left this new system in place that was based deliberately, consciously, on imposing a sectarian-based system of political parties that had never existed in Iraq before. That's the challenge that we face now. And this is now a global war again. Yes, the U.S. is leading, not a surprise. We spend more than the top 9 other countries, including China, including all of our so-called enemies, more than all of them together. We spend billions and billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars on the military every year, something most other countries are smart enough not to do. So it's not surprising that our assumption is that if there's a problem, it's going to be the military that has the solution. It's the old hammer and the nail. If you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. If you're the Pentagon, everything looks like it needs a military solution. The problem is that seems to be the problem in the White House and in the State Department and in Congress as well. For any of us, if we have a problem, call the Marines. That's a serious problem. Because put aside international law, put aside the morality of killing innocent people, inevitably, and just look at the success. You can't find it. Because the military solutions are failing. They've failed in the past, they're failing now, and there is absolutely zero reason to think they're going to succeed in the future. So this notion of saying that, well, San Bernardino changed everything. Paris changed everything. Ankara changed everything. None of these incidents change everything, except for the victims and their families. For them, yes, it changes everything. But it doesn't change the world. It was the same for us on 9/11. We had never experienced, no one in this country was alive the last time the United States was attacked. Pearl Harbor was not in a U.S. state. Hawaii wasn't even a state at that time. Nobody was alive when we were attacked from outside. So it was not surprising that people were paralyzed with fear. But the reality was, as horrific a crime as 9/11 was, a crime against humanity, it did not pose an existential threat to the United States. It did not threaten our democracy. It did not threaten our country. What threatened our country and continues to threaten, what threatened our democracy and continues to threaten, is what happened on September 12th, not September 11th, when the president announced that the response to this horrific crime would be to take the world to war. We were given the choice. We either go to war or we let them get away with it. You're either with us or you're with the terrorists. And if you're not with us, we will treat you as if you too were a terrorist. And we have treated people around the world and in our own country as if they were terrorists from that day forward. The problem is, you can't bomb terrorism out of existence. You can't bomb terrorism at all. You can only bomb people. You can bomb cities. Sometimes you might get lucky. You might hit a terrorist. You might kill a terrorist. But that doesn't eliminate the terrorism. It just creates more. There is no military solution. The solution lies in changing the conditions that give rise to terrorism in the first place and that make people's lives so desperate that they're prepared to embrace a level of horrific, violent terrorism because it still seems better than what they have at home. That's what we can change. Not fast. It's not sexy. Doesn't make good television, but it's the only thing that will work. The talks that began in the last couple of days in Vienna, the Syria talks, I don't know if it's going to work. It's hugely problematic because it's really 9 separate wars that are being fought, all to the last Syrian, but the people who are at the table first are not any Syrians. It's the supporters, the outside supporters. Now, maybe that's what has to happen first. Maybe there has to be an agreement on a ceasefire between the U.S. and the Saudis and Turkey on the one hand and Russia and Iran on the other hand before you even bring in the Syrian regime and the Syrian opposition. Is that fair? Of course not. Is it just? Of course not. But the goal here is not about winning the war. It's about stopping a horrific war. And those who are trying to win it are not going to be happy by simply stopping it where it is, stopping it in place. But that's probably what needs to happen first. And it's not at all clear that Di Mistura and his team from the United Nations are going to be able to pull that off. What we do know is that the potential for broadening the diplomacy over war that was represented in the U.S.-Iran nuclear deal, the potential for broadening that to a much bigger level of normalization between those two countries is not a done deal. It's still a possibility, but it may be that there is just not the willingness, more likely in Washington than in Tehran. There's problems in Tehran too, but the problems are more likely to come from Congress than from the hardliners in the Iranian Majlis, in the Iranian parliament. We don't know if that's going to work. It is a possibility, but the U.S. has been responding militarily, bolstering its military support of the Saudis as they take on Iran in the region, bolstering U.S. support for the Saudi war in Yemen. None of this is going to help in the effort to broaden the victory of diplomacy over war that was represented in that Iranian nuclear deal. The military strategy is still failing. And every time we hear presidential candidates saying, I would do it better, I would light up the sands, I would use nukes, I would take them out, this is a serious problem. This is what the world is hearing from our elections. Who can outdo the next one in the talk of killing more people around the world? In the name of keeping Americans safe, when the reality is it puts us at much greater risk. It doesn't keep us safe. It's what engenders more anger and more terrorism at the end of the day. If we look right now, we have been at war against terrorism for 15 years. And where do we stand now? Suddenly ISIS is controlling territory. The Taliban, according to new military reports 2 days ago, now control more territory than they have since 2001. The Pentagon spends $500 million to create and train a Syrian opposition force that would be loyal to the United States, that would go after ISIS and wouldn't go after Assad, and would do things our way and be democratic and secular and not touch any of the Islamist forces. And what happened? They couldn't find any. Well, not entirely true. They found 54. No, they found 54. They sent them in to fight, and within 2 days, half of them had either defected, been killed, or put down their weapons and fled. The other 26 went back to fight, and they were almost all killed. $500 million. It comes out to pretty much, I can't do the math, but it's like more than $1 million each to train these guys. I mean, talk about a bad use of money. And ISIS still controls territory. Yes, they have lost some territory in recent months, and the U.S. tells us that's a great victory. Ramadi has been free of ISIS. Well, you could argue that's a victory. Defeating ISIS pretty much anywhere should be seen as a victory. But what did it really mean on the ground? ISIS had done enormous damage, not only to people, but to the city of Ramadi. But it was the U.S. bombing that finished it off. Those who have survived the siege of Ramadi have nothing to go back to. Their town is in ruins. It goes back to the Vietnam era. We had to destroy the village in order to save it. But this was no village. This was a city of 300,000 people. And the survivors of those 300,000 have no city to go back to. It's been destroyed. And in the meantime, ISIS is now going back to its old form of soft target terrorism. As they lose more territory. Yeah, we can use the military for that. That would probably work. We can reduce their control of territory. And what happens? They go back to another form of terror. That's not a solution, because it's done nothing to change the conditions that result in an ordinary Sunni doctor going off to join ISIS because it seems like a lesser evil than the horrific sectarian government in Baghdad that we are keeping in power. So Obama is right when he says there is no military solution. The problem is there's no one holding him accountable to his own words. And that failure, it means that you have to do something different. You have to learn from what the genius taught us, that you can't keep doing the same thing and expect a different result. So what does that look like? In Afghanistan, the new report that just came out from the special investigative, the special inspector general, the Taliban controls more territory, that of the $113 billion the U.S. has spent on education, this is supposedly the great thing we've achieved, right? At least we got the kids in school. Well, turns out, not so much. Of the $113 billion, $17 billion is, just over 3 years, is already lost to corruption. And the main claim, we've got the kids, especially the girls, into school. It turns out that right now, 42% of Afghan children of elementary school age have either never been to school or have already dropped out. We have failed, and we have been lied to about what the war has brought to the people of Afghanistan. So when we look at this question, what was the origin of ISIS? There's a reason that I start sometimes by asking, you know, how many people have heard this line that ISIS began when the troops were pulled out? Well, they became visible in Syria around that same time, but their origins were years before. They changed their name, they changed what they believed in. They're a very changeable batch of fighters. But their history began fighting against foreign occupation in 2004. So when we look at that, we have to look at the impact that that has had on people in the region, on people around the rest of the world, and recognize what it means. Why are they so powerful? How did this happen? It's because they don't fight alone. Because when the U.S. went into Iraq and invaded Iraq, the first thing it did was to dissolve the military and throw out all the generals and all the colonels, and quite a ways down, I think as low as the sergeants. And all those people suddenly had lost their job, lost their privileges, sent home with no way to support their family, nothing but their weapons that they took with them. And they've been seething ever since. They've been angry ever since. They've been looking for revenge ever since. And ISIS shows up, and that's where they find it. So that's who's providing the military strategy and the training and the weapons training of all of that. It's not the ISIS militants themselves. They didn't just figure out how to do all this stuff. It's they've got the top generals that fought under Saddam Hussein. And those generals, quite frankly, were pretty good generals. They knew how to fight. That's why ISIS is having success now. So what does all this mean? What do we do about all this? We can look at all the origins of the crisis, and there are many. The role of climate change is huge here. The drought that began in Syria in 2006 and went through about 2010 drove somewhere like 800,000 farmers off their land. Syria was once the breadbasket of the region. That's where the wheat grows. And suddenly there was no rain, so there was no wheat. Farmers couldn't make a living, so they flooded into the cities looking for jobs. But neoliberalism had come to Syria in those last years, so there were no jobs. There were a few, but the few jobs go to somebody who knows somebody in power. That was more likely to be an Alawite who knew some other Alawite family, because the Alawites were privileged. And so you're exacerbating again the sectarianism that hadn't really been that much of an issue in Syria. Before the crisis, Syria had had a huge middle class. It had the smallest wealth-poverty gap in the whole region. So now, there's people that are desperate. That's what leads to an uprising. That's what created the initial, what seemed so optimistic, the Arab Spring coming to Damascus. And then the repression sets in by this dictatorial regime. And then the war begins, and suddenly it expands, and it's now, as I said, it's at least 8 or 9 separate wars. It's regional wars between Iran and Saudi Arabia being fought to the last Syrian. It's also a religious war between Sunni and Shia, also between Iran and Saudi Arabia being fought to the last Syrian. It's a war between the U.S. and Russia over things like naval bases and sea lanes being fought to the last Syrian. At the moment, it's also a war between Turkey and the Kurds, partly being fought to the last Syrian. So the question of how do we stop this war and what do we have to do to stop ISIS and stop the Syrian war become enormous challenges. What are we doing wrong? Well, if you look from August of 2014, when the U.S. began its war against ISIS, the people of Washington State alone have paid $154 million in taxes. Your money. Just for that brief period, just for the war against ISIS. That doesn't count the war in Afghanistan. That doesn't count the war in Iraq that was already underway. It doesn't count the military budget. It doesn't count the bases. It doesn't count the nuclear weapons. It doesn't count anything except for just the so-called war against ISIS. If you had kept that money at home, here's a couple things you could have done with it. You could have had 1,524 kids in Head Start every year for 10 years. You could have had 1,624 veterans getting health care every year for 10 years. You could have 4,219 students getting four-year scholarships to the university. What makes us safer? Jobs and health care and education at home? Or wasting our money on wars around the world that make people hate us and turn against us and turn to terrorism?
And here we must pause. Please tune in again next week for the conclusion of Phyllis Bennis's talk, plus selections from the Q&A. For the original recording, our thanks to Mike McCormick, host of Mind Over Matters in Seattle. And thank you for listening to New World Notes. Find us on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. We come to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. On behalf of the entire New World Notes staff, that's me, myself, and our fashion correspondent, Monica Lewinsky. On behalf of the entire staff, this is Kenneth Doust, advising, illegitimi non carborundum, keep the aspidistra flying, an injury to one is an injury to all, and please come back again next week. Ciao.